Broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and today my guests are Akhil Sharma, author of An Obedient Father, and Gina Nahai, author of Sunday Silence. Oh, more questions and so little time in which to ask them. What you both read and discussed have raised a lot of things. One is finding your voice, and I wonder if both of you think that all of your work sounds alike, or does each story, each book, does it take a different sort of voice? Gina.
Well, both of those things. But here's the interesting thing. Yes, to answer your question, each book does sound in parts different. And in parts, there is that the voice that perhaps is more unique to me than the other. Interesting thing is that the reaction from the readers and the critics from book to book is they feel terribly betrayed when they hear the other, the less unique voice in there. And it really is as if, and I've noticed this also in the work of other writers, especially what we call ethnic writers, writers whose primary language is not English. Mm-hmm. And it really is as if there is an expectation on the part of the reviewers, and a lot of the readers, for you to write and sound very much like the person from that part of the world and the way they imagine you should sound. Mm. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but for instance, with this book, Sunday Silence, as much as I have been praised and compared to Faulkner and Tennessee Williams and so on, I've also, by some reviewers, a lot of them are also saying, well, we wonder why she's writing about America. Why not write about Iran? And why not write about Jews? Why write about Christians? And I just recently saw that in the work of actually an Indian, a female Indian writer, the same thing. Well, you know, if you are writing fiction or nonfiction, part of the journey is to be able to write about others, other places, other things, what you know, and also what you don't know.
Yes.
And a lot of times the voice will change because it's more generic to the subject matter.
And in Sunday Silence, going from first person to third, what prompted that?
Well, I was walking around hearing her voice all the time, and so that had to be, her story had to be told in her own voice. I just couldn't help that. So she's talking to him. And I really wanted to explore this. The relationship you build when you are speaking with someone directly. Here she's talking to her lover, which is really also talking to the reader. When you're talking to them, to someone directly, the lies you can tell them and the truths you can tell them, that's very different than if you're talking in an omniscient voice, so to everyone and no one, right? But I also needed an omniscient voice because his story and his background spans the entire question of the settlement of the Appalachians initially by white Europeans and Pentecostalism and the holy rollers and all of that. And so that the omniscient voice was just an easier vehicle. Plus which, since he is the one who's really trying to understand the essence of faith and extremism, religious extremism, I wanted to have the freedom to move from point of view to point of view, which obviously is easier in omniscient.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Akhil, talk to me about voice.
I have there's a chapter in the book which has a very different voice than other chapters. There's a chapter when Ram Karan's daughter is remembering her marriage, and it's a chapter which is much more spoken, much more reliant on rhythm. So it'll be a sense. It opens with something like, late one June afternoon, 7 months after my marriage, I woke from a short, deep sleep in love with my husband. So, you know, a lot of alliteration, a much stronger sense of rhythm. And there are times when I do things like that to create a voice, to create what seems very different. But it's more interesting, it's more challenging to create a different sensibility. And that I found, and it's, I find that it's these are things that you can create by just entering the situation and trying to experience it deeply and trying to be true to it. I think that it's hard to continue on Gina's comment about how to carry from place to go within a novel from voice to voice. I agree with her to a large extent that it just, in a lot of ways, third person is just much easier. And when you do that, you end up giving up a little bit of the, you have to give away some of the uniqueness of the third person, of the I.
I do have to say something, though, if I may. I teach creative writing. People writing novels, right? Most of the students are people who are well into these novels, and we go through this all the time. I think every story has its own need. Some stories really need to be told in the first person or from a tight point of view, and others from different kinds of point of view. And a lot of times I'll spend the entire semester working on a student with this, and suddenly when they switch the point of view or the voice, suddenly it's like the book is so much better, so much more exciting, and the writer then is also so thrilled because this is what they were trying to do all along without really knowing it. So I don't know if it's easier to write in one point of view or another. I think it's just depends on the story.
I would agree, but I think if you're a young writer, it often helps to try writing in multiple points of view, just to see, or even the same story, to see when it comes alive for you. For example, you know, Memoirs of a Geisha was written, the first couple of attempts to sell the book was written in third person, and it was dreadful, according to the writer. Nobody wanted the book, and then he wrote it again in first person, and it suddenly came alive, and it came alive because maybe it centered it for him, maybe it was, it forced him into an imaginative space that he was not able to get into as a third person, or maybe it was just better for a reader. But the choosing a first person or a third person, choosing the character who's going to be the point of view, is essential.
Yes. Well, coming to that point of view, is it more coming to it from your own feelings of I'm not excited by this story, or someone else isn't excited by it, or just experimenting, like the students you were speaking of, Gina, were they, or are they having trouble, you know, really getting into the life of the story, and so you might say try something else?
No, I'm having trouble. No, what happens is this: there's a story there that's very good, and you can see the story is very good, but as it's told, it doesn't work. There's scene after scene after scene, and there's action and all of that, but it's just not happening. And so, you know, it's like running out of steam. By page 70, 80, 90, you're suddenly slowing down, and, well, I just don't want to read anymore, and you don't know why, right? Or the writer doesn't know why, as when they come into my class. When they graduate, they're all Nobel laureates, obviously. No, and so that then when you try to change it, a lot of times also we speak a lot about what is the story that you really want to tell. I think a lot of times, as Akhil was saying, when you start, a younger writer will feel that, well, I want to tell this story, but, well, that's not exciting enough. That's not what people want to read. Or, well, I mean, who cares about a love affair between a white girl and an African-American man these days? And so I will couch that and put three layers of other stuff on top, right? Mm-hmm. And so you have to strip away those layers as the teacher. I don't know if you agree with me or not. I know you teach, Barbara. But when you get to the bottom, then you have this fabulous love affair, fabulous tale told from the point of view of this young girl who's just fallen in love with sort of a man that she's not allowed to be in love with. And it's touching and wonderful and a great big adventure that you can write 800 pages about. You really didn't need that third person omniscient and all the other kinds of action that she imagined she needed, the writer. You see?
Yes, it's interesting.
I mean, there are also some writers who don't have the talent to stay within. Because I think to write an interesting book from one point of view is a very particular talent. And there are people whose gift is a gift of incident. you know, such as Michael Chabon. And though, you know, what makes the book, what makes, you know, Wonder Boys interesting or what makes Clavery and Clay interesting are not, you know, the characters so much as the incidents themselves.
Mm. Yeah.
So, you know, so one writer could write a story about a young girl falling in love with an African American man, and it'll be beautiful if it's just that distilled story. Another person will write it and it'll be dreck, because that's just not, that ability to make an inner life come alive is not that person's talent. And so it's better for that person to apply a third person or to set it within a more interesting scenario.
Interesting.
See, Akil is more proactive, I think, as a writer.
Well, I wonder.
Than I am. You're right, though. I mean, you are right. I do wonder, though, if it's a question of talent. And you know what? Talent, yes, it's God-given. But so much of writing can be taught. The craft of it can be taught. But you're right. So if you don't have the talent, though, I wonder, with all the action, if you end up still with a first-rate book, or if you're still going to end up with a second-rate book. It's like having, you know, a great big masterpiece of a film, or having one of those video game movies, you know, Driven or Gone in 60 Seconds, and that's all action, but is it a great film?
Interesting. I wonder if men and women just sort of deal with writing a little differently. You know, I mean, men perhaps, are men more logical? Are women more intuitive in the way they write?
I'm not a big believer in that. I mean, if you read Zadie Smith's White Teeth, it's a fantastic book, it doesn't feel like an intuitive book.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a constructed book. If you read Alice McDermott's Charming Billy or At Weddings and Wakes, which is, I think, her best book, it feels very much a discovered book. And you'll find the same thing with both male and, I mean, you'll find the exact same thing with male writers. You know that, but in the end, I mean, I keep coming back to the idea that a book, you know, is for the reader. It's not, and what the story you want to write, you know, this might not best be served with the original vision that you started with.
Mm-hmm.
You might have started thinking this is a small story or this is a big story, and either the story itself cannot hold that much weight on it, if it's too slight, or if the characters are mean-hearted, then your sort of deep love of the characters isn't going to rescue it. Or it could be that you don't have this particular sensibility, a sensibility that will make this sort of story come alive. And this is, I mean, I agree with Gina about how you can learn writing, but there, you know, you have to be, if you don't have a particular voice, to learn how to create a particular voice, to create a story, the story you had originally wanted to write, you need an enormous amount of craft.
Interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM. My guests are Akil Sharma, author of An Obedient Father, and Gina Nahai, author of Sunday's Silence. Something else I noticed that new writers have trouble with is conflict. And in these books, the conflict is solid. It's just, you know, it's there from the beginning. Is conflict easy for you both, or is that something that you just, you know, you're looking to, as one of you said, apply the layers?
I think conflict really is the easiest thing in the world. It is an outside conflict. Inner conflict, obviously, is a lot more difficult to pinpoint and then to portray and resolve or leave unresolved. But an outer conflict is the easiest thing in the world to create.
Really?
You just have to go back to the, I don't know, Greek mythology, Iranian mythology, and Indian mythology, and so on. And, you know, it's always the same thing, love, hate, betrayal, envy, right?
Yes.
And somebody wants the same house that somebody else owns, and they're going to kill each other over it. It's a question of being able to exercise the right amount of restraint in developing the conflict, though. See, That's the trouble. Not finding conflict. I mean, give me any two characters and I can tell you three different conflicts they can have at any given time. But how do you then exercise restraint? I mean, how do you write about the Holocaust and not show 6 million people dead one at a time, right? You have to write with restraint, and then you have Schindler's List.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Akhil?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. The problem is not creating the conflict. The problem is making it interesting, of control within you know, within the whatever is the dynamic of the struggle. Just the you know, I mean, what a, my definition of a good book is that you want to keep turning the pages.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's just, or that you're just interested in it page by page, even if you dread turning the page.
Interesting. Yeah, I think I see that though. And I don't know what the problem is getting to that conflict for certain writers. It's almost that things are too subtle. They're not on the page enough because the writer's afraid perhaps of overkill.
Yeah, but see, then what I recommend to them, and a lot of times what I do with them in the class with the submissions that they bring in, is we read through it, through the work, not the whole 500 pages, you know, 15, 20 pages at a time. And as you are reading, there will be a paragraph, there will be a passage that is striking. I mean, if they are accomplished enough as a writer to have written something that even resembles a novel, then or a short story, then there will be a passage, a paragraph, something that's striking. And if you pay attention to that, very often there is your conflict.
Hmm. That's interesting.
Or out of that, you develop that. That's the heart of the story. And really, at the heart of every story, there is some sort of conflict.
Mm-hmm.
I think David Mamet said, you know, that you have a theater audience watching Hamlet. In the audience, you suddenly have two people begin to punch at each other. And even if the play goes on, everybody wants to watch the fist fight. And that's what it is. I mean, in the end, the only thing that's interesting is real life being lived by real people.
I think David Mamet said that when he was feeling really low about being a play fighter.
That's interesting.
That's the thing that endures, human beings living their lives.
Mm-hmm. It's life. Life is in the details.
Yeah.
We have a couple of minutes left, and I'm wondering as well, there's so many things here I'd like to talk about. If your beginning paragraphs of these books were the original beginning paragraphs, or did you come to them later after you had finished a draft or two?
I'm sorry, go ahead, Akhil.
I came back a long time later. Once I had written the book, I went back and began putting in certain things that I needed to set it up.
Mm-hmm. So did your original paragraph look a lot different than this one?
It's gone.
Mm-hmm.
Gone. I mean, it appears actually nowhere in the book.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it. I find that actually whenever I'm writing, whenever I begin a new chapter or a new section within a chapter, the first day of work is garbage.
Yeah.
Because whatever you might be, and you have to write that garbage, I think, because whatever is motivating you to write that stuff is also what's going to motivate you to write the rest of the book.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Jean?
Now, my beginning paragraphs are always, you know, they're the voices, my little imaginary friends and the little imaginary voices, but in all the three books, they're there, and they change very little from the first draft to draft number whatever, to the end of the book. Very often, though, Akhil is right, the first chapter turns out to be garbage, and the first few chapters may be garbage, but the voice and what she says in this, Moonlight on the Avenue of Fate, the first paragraph was about a page long. And that was it. I always heard this, and she started speaking that way long before I even knew how old this character was and so on. Her age changed, her marital status changed, everything changed in the rewrites, which of course will reflect in the first chapter. But that first paragraph never changed.
Both of you seem, you've created worlds here that seem extremely, extremely real. And Akhil, you left India at 9, and, you know, as you said, Gina, you're writing about a world that you haven't lived in. Have you done a lot of research to get this just right, or what? I mean, your worlds are extremely real. What you've put here on the page.
Thank you.
I left India when I was quite young, but I used to go back very often, and I was in India during the 7 months or so, right around when Rajiv Gandhi was assassinated, which is when the action of the novel occurs.
Mm.
There are parts of the world which I did not know. You know, there are morgues that I had not been to, you know, in my normal life. There are certain types of people that I had not met, and I researched it. You know, I trust my imagination to occupy a character or a space, but I also know enough to think that life is more surprising, more complicated than I can imagine.
And do you worry about, say, people reading your book who are living where you're writing about, saying, "No, no, no, that's not there. That store isn't there. That wouldn't happen there."
You know, I remember reading an essay by some professor, literature professor, who was complaining that in The Old Man and the Sea, the mile of line that the old man is carrying down to the boat would weigh like 200 pounds to carry it. And I just think nobody remembers that guy, nobody remembers that essay, but people know The Old Man and the Sea.
Mm.
So what people will remember and carry with them is the life of the book.
Yeah, that's interesting. Gina?
Well, here's the interesting thing. The parts of my books that have taken place in America, Sunday Silence and the others, I've researched for years and then traveled and lived in and tried, not lived in permanently, but traveled through and tried to absorb. And then when I have all the details down to the store and what stoplight is at which intersection and all of the things that you're talking about, and yes, I do try to be accurate and not get called on for that kind of stuff, then I try to write more viscerally. I try to write about the place as if it really were only in my imagination. By contrast, when I write about Iran, the Iran that I have written about is not the Iran that I saw or remember. It's based on oral history, a lot of interviews, something like 12 years of interviews for the two books, and the Iranian character in this book, and all of that is other people's memories. And so that really does become a visceral way of rendering the place than a more of a visual, factual way. In all these cases, everyone's come back, people who've lived there and said, yes, this is so accurate, I cannot believe how real it is. Sometimes people will say things like, it wasn't as dark and gloomy as you say it was. That's not how I remember it. You know, but that's really just the subjective renderings of a time and a place.
Yes. We have a minute left. I wonder if you both could offer up some last words for the beginning writers listening. For any writer listening.
Akhil, you want to go for it?
Yeah. I mean, the one advice I would say is, look, read a lot. I'm always amazed by how little aspiring writers have read. And the other thing I would say is, you know, don't be arrogant. Think about your reader.
Okay. Very
well. Well, I would say something else. I would say write with as much passion and as much desire as you possibly have in you. Be prepared for obscurity. A lot of writers think there's going to be millions of readers and millions of dollars around every bend, and that comes with either Oprah or or writing many books over a long period of time. But once you prepare for that, and once you write for the long term, once you write so that you will be read in 100 years, I think Moby Dick sold 300 copies initially or something, then you will write a lot better.
Interesting. Thank you both so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. That was Gina Nahai, author of Sunday Silence, and Akhil Sharma, author of An Obedient Father, both published by Harcourt. And I must say the covers of these books are wonderful. things to look at. If you have comments or questions or would like to know about future guests and events in the area, visit my website at writersonwriting.com, and you can also sign up there to be on the mailing list. We have a few minutes left, and I want to read something to you. I don't have a commentary prepared for today, but I want to read to you a poem by Theodore Rotsky that I've liked for so many years, and I came across it today in a book called The Making of a Poem by Mark Strand and Evan Boland. So here it goes. The waking. I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. I feel my fate and what I cannot fear. I learn by going where I have to go. We think by feeling. What is there to know? I hear my being dance from ear to ear. I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. Of those so close beside me, which are you? God bless the ground. I shall walk softly there and learn by going where I have to go. Light takes the tree, but who can tell us how? The lowly worm climbs up a winding stair. I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. Great nature has another thing to do to you and me, so take the lively air and lovely learn by going where to go. This shaking keeps me steady. I should know what falls away is always and is near. I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. I learn by going where I have to go. That's it. You've been listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And in 1852, Harriet Beecher Stowe, author of Uncle Tom's Cabin, said, "No one is so thoroughly superstitious as the godless man." Thank you for listening, and stay safe.